When I first started thinking about what was I going to talk about tonight, this was last week, I was actually in meditation, and the words compassionate heart just dropped into my awareness. And I thought, oh, well, I guess I have my marching orders. You know, one of those intuitive flashes that comes, and I thought, aha, that's a wonderful subject. So I've been contemplating that over on and off over the last few days and would like to explore it together with you. I started with a memory from a couple of years ago when I was invited to a lovely house off of Brattle Street for a reception for His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And there were about 60 people gathered into a quite small reception space, kind of a big front hall. And of course, you can imagine there was a lot of anticipation that the Dalai Lama was coming. And he came in the front door, and he walked through this crowd of people, and he looked around like this. And his eye fell upon a woman who was in a big cast, and he immediately went over to her and began talking to her. And I didn't hear what he said, but the point is that it seems wherever he goes, he's scanning for where the greatest pain is. And Sharon Salzberg, one of our teachers, tells a very similar story about the first time that His Holiness came to IMS, Insight Meditation Society, in Barre, Massachusetts. And a lot of people appeared, even though Barre is rural and everything, but you know, he was coming. And Sharon had just been in a very bad automobile accident, and she'd been badly injured, and she was on crutches. And she was feeling really dismal and out of it, and dismayed that she couldn't get around, and she was at the very back of the crowd. And His Holiness got out of the car, and again, he looked over the crowd, and he came right through the crowd up to Sharon, and he took her hand, and he said, "What happened?" And she told him, and she said it was as though all the burden of what she'd been carrying was just lifted by his compassionate action. So those two stories came to my mind, that this is compassion in action. And so let's see how this relates to us, because deepening in compassion is both the beginning all the way to the end of our spiritual journey. It's a constant process. I don't think we're aware of it, but then we see little openings. We see how our heart is opening. So let's go to some background. This takes us to the first century of the Common Era in northern India, when a famous and much-loved sutra was written, the Heart Sutra. And the sort of essential message of that sutra is that it extols the power, if you will, of the boundlessness of the compassionate heart. And out of that comes two of the sort of, one symbolic figure, which you may have seen in the iconography in the Tibetan tradition, namely Avalokiteshvara, who is the embodiment of compassion, also known as Chenrezig. And have you seen any of those images of a statue with 1,000 arms? Yeah. And every hand has an eye in the palm. So the great sort of sweep of compassion of Avalokiteshvara, those eyes are watching, listening for the cries of the world. And that's such a powerful image to convey to us what that kind of vision might be. Now, when the Lotus Sutra was translated into Chinese and these teachings began to move through China, that's when the figure of Kuan Yin appeared. And many of you know of Kuan Yin. She's the female embodiment of compassion. And it's really interesting and to me very beautiful that this figure, a symbolic embodiment, if you will, appears in both male and female forms. I love that she's in a female form. And perhaps some of you can visualize her. because there are, of course, many, many representations of Kuan Yin. And she's sitting with one leg drawn up in meditative posture, but the other leg is down. And that's to symbolize that she is ready to fly into action in response to the suffering that she hears in the world. And so her words are, or she is described, as the one who hears the cries of the world. The one who hears the cries of the world. So when she appeared in, or when this, if you will, symbolic embodiment appeared in Tibet, it came in the form of Tara. Probably green Tara is the most well-known, but there are 21 forms of Tara. And then moving westward, many people feel that Mary in the Christian tradition is yet another embodiment, of course, of compassion. So there's this vast spread across many, many cultures. They're trying to represent her. And the most famous one, her face is totally serene. Her eyes are open so she can see what is happening in the world. She embodies equanimity, and I'll come back to that subject later on. And sometimes in China, she's holding a willow branch, and that apparently symbolizes flexibility, the flexibility that hopefully we're cultivating as we practice and practice and practice. So out of this very quick sort of historic broad brush that I'm giving you comes the Bodhisattva vow. And as you know, a Bodhisattva is the one who has put off their final enlightenment or final liberation so that they can return to help with the suffering of the world. Now, perhaps you know the first line of the Bodhisattva vow, which is, though beings are numberless, I vow to save them. And I'll read their four lines. They're very powerful. Though greed, hatred, and ignorance rise endlessly, I vow to end them. Though the path is vast and fathomless, I vow to understand it. Though enlightenment is beyond attainment, I vow to embody it fully. Parenthesis. I want to take issue with that last one. A lot of time's gone by, and we know that enlightenment is possible. It's possible in one lifetime, and it's possible in a female body. I say that because with the long patriarch tradition of Buddhism, for a long time it was thought and taught that women could not become enlightened, but that is no longer a teaching. I just have to add that here. So we have balance, okay? Very important. But this statement, though beings are numberless, I vow to save them, it's a very high aspiration. You know, it's really kind of daunting, don't you think? It's like, I vow to save them? I've certainly felt that way about it. But I think that we need to remember that our compassion expresses itself in the littlest moments. This is really important. It's when we decide to be really present to another person. It's when we decide that, we don't decide, we're just present with deep listening to another, or just a kind touch, or a kind word, or stopping to make contact with the checkout person at the market, or letting somebody go ahead of you in traffic. even don't you sometimes feel that's compassionate when someone does that for you? And then you notice how the next person does it? I know I've said this here before, but I'm very into the yoga of driving because I have a lot to learn. I notice I get picked up in the sort of rush of Boston drivers. It's contagious. So it's a great opportunity to practice kindness. So these are just some examples, stopping perhaps to give something to a homeless person. These are small things, but these are the ways in which we express compassion in action. So going back to something very basic, which is the definition of this word, it's defined as the heart that trembles in response to pain. The heart that trembles in response to pain. So I want to make the distinction here between compassion and pity. Compassion is feeling with the other person. It's empathy. It's being attuned to the other. Whereas pity is feeling for the other. And it maintains a feeling of sort of separateness from the other. It's a little distance in it. It has a very different feeling to it. And in fact, I'll say more about this too in a moment. It's considered one of the near enemies of compassion. It's interesting in the Buddhist tradition that some of these key words have either a near enemy and a far enemy. And so I'll say more about that in a minute. Modern brain research has come up with, I think, a wonderful teaching, if you will, or a wonderful discovery, that we have mirror neurons in our brain, and they're in the prefrontal cortex. They're in here. And it's that, it's been called our compassion circuitry, and it's that which enables us to tune into the feeling state of another person, to feel how they are feeling, to be attuned to them. And I just love that, modern science, this very sophisticated research, comes up with these mirror neurons. In other words, just validating what we know through our own experience. It's a beautiful idea. So there's really a kind of alchemy that happens when we open to pain, someone else's pain, allow it to touch us and respond however we're called to respond. This is alchemy, because something transmutes, something happens in those moments. And they may be very small moments, but they're very precious moments. The teachings tell us, and our teachers tell us, that we all are born with compassion. It's up here, it's here, it's mainly here in the heart. And we lose touch with it. We close down, we shut down, we get overcome. So I want to pause here for a moment and pay tribute again to Sharon Salzberg, whom I saw just day before yesterday at a gathering. She's one of the original three teachers with Jack Kornfield and Joseph Goldstein who really brought Vipassana to the West, three of the earliest Vipassana teachers. And she was paying tribute to another Dharma teacher who was retiring from his job. And just to hear how much she and these others have done to bring these wisdom teachings to us, it's really heartwarming. So I want to pay tribute to Sharon because she sets this forth in some of her teachings, a way to approach a deeper understanding of compassion. She says there are four steps. And the first step is recognizing that pain and sorrow exist. Now you may say, but that's so obvious, of course. But it sent me back to thinking about my family of origin, where suffering was denied and avoided. And because my mother had several nervous breakdowns, my father worked really hard to try to keep this family together emotionally. So any kind of extreme emotions were charged and had an edge. And when my mother spoke about something that had happened to somebody else that was very painful, an accident or an illness or a death, there was a kind of curious edge in her voice that I, as a child, picked up, that there was something strange, there was something off. And what was off was this denial, was this trying to push it away and sort of say suffering was something that happened to other people. Can you imagine? It's subtle, but it was very, very hard to have that reality. And it wasn't until I really heard the Buddha's teachings that I felt this sense of relief that somebody was saying, look, the human life, it always will have its challenges. It's going to have pain. Of course we will suffer, but there's also a way out. That's what these teachings tell us. So that was a great relief to me. So I just want to also point out, if you look at our culture carefully, you see that there are all kinds of ways in which we try to push away pain. Addiction, drugs, alcohol, being very, very busy can often be a cover for trying not to feel what is really happening in our lives. We are a culture that is quite gifted at trying to push it away, medicate it away. So I just point that out, that the Buddhist teachings are saying, no, we need to look at reality straight on. And it's only then that our struggle with the reality of what is begins to quiet down. So this first step, recognizing that pain and sorrow exist. So you can't talk about compassion without talking about suffering, because they're inextricably connected. So the second step is opening to pain and accepting it, and stop running from it, especially our own. And I mean, don't you know that feeling when you have a sudden pain and it's like the mind takes off, doesn't it? And you know, we fly for the Tylenol or something. Working with pain becomes a very central part of our practice. So we have to stand still, receive it. What are these sensations? What is this? Or how about the pain of the world? How about hearing the cries of the world? So we have to let go of our judgments, our finding fault, or our trying to fix it, because often there's not a thing that we can do except to accept that this is the reality. The cries of the world are also your cries. They're my cries. They're our cries. So it's a really important recognition, the universality of sorrow. But it isn't easy. And here's where I want to come back to the near enemies of compassion. What are they? They're pity, as I said. Are there any contracted mental or emotional state? They're fear or anger or grief. All of these are the so-called enemies of compassion. Also despair. Sometimes do you notice feelings of numbness or helplessness, or maybe even indifference, or why bother? It's too hard. I don't want to deal with it. Have you ever felt that way? I know I have. Yet when we do that, we end up feeling cut off, and that's not comfortable either. So what is the far enemy of compassion? It's cruelty. And when I thought about that, my mind went instantly to what's happening at the southern border with Mexico. It's just a heartbreak. And when I first read about it, I was so angry. I was so outraged. Now look what they're doing. They're separating children, little children, from one year old, 3, 4, 5. They're tearing them out of the arms of their parents, and they'll never be seen again. That's what's being done in our name. And to me, this, to all of us, this is so excruciating. And yet, what do we do? What do we do when we're hit with a reality like that? So I know what happened to me was, at first I ranted and raved to my partner at the breakfast table, and I was really, really mad. And then I realized that it had sent me into my heart, that I was feeling for those parents, I was feeling for those children. And so here is, interestingly enough, how compassion is bittersweet. And I only read this in a book on psychology last week, where the writer said, compassion is bittersweet. I thought, that's really helpful to me, because the bitter part of it is what I just described, something that we hear, the news coming to us, or some reality that hits us in our life, learning that a parent is dying, hearing about an accident or reading about something awful in the news, that's the bitter part. Because reality isn't what we wish it would to be. Isn't it true? We have these idealizations of how we would like life to be, and it isn't like that. It comes and it hits us, and that's the bitter part. But the sweet part, it's bittersweet, is that it hits us in the heart, and it takes us into these deeper feelings of compassion, these deeper feelings of empathy, of feeling for the other. So listen to these words of Thomas Merton. He was a Christian, he was a Trappist monk in the Christian tradition, a mystic, a theologian, a prolific writer. And he said, he really understood this because he suffered and he wrote about it. He said, true prayer begins in the moments when all the doors are closed and our hearts have turned to stone. Do you know that place? I know that place. True prayer begins in the moments when all the doors are closed and our hearts are turned to stone. And yet sometimes the turning points in our lives come out of our brokenness. They come out of our desperation. They come out of the hardest times. And we don't know it when we're in the middle of those times, but in retrospect, we may see them. One of my favorite sayings is from the Sufi tradition. It goes like this, very simple. Where we stumble and fall, there we find the gold. Where we stumble and fall, there we find the gold. So what does it mean? It means that there are gifts even in suffering. And actually, I want to tell you a story. I told it here quite a while ago in connection with my first book. It was where one of these surprises came and hit me out of the blue at a time when I was feeling very desolate. And it was actually on retreat at Barry at IMS. And my husband was in about the fourth year of Alzheimer's. And it was getting to be a really hard time. It was heartbreaking. It was hard. I was exhausted. I was really glad to be on retreat, and he was there too. Probably shouldn't have been there because he walked into some yogi's room by mistake. He was dealing with some disorientation, but it was important he was there too. In any case, it was New Year's Day. And although we're not supposed to read when we go to Barry, I had taken a book of Rumi's poems. And I wonder if you ever do this. Do you ever open a book looking for a message? So on that morning, I said to myself, I'm going to open this book and look two-thirds of the way down the right-hand page. So I opened the book, and this message blew me away. And you probably won't get it right away, so I'll explicate it. But these were the words. Always check your inner state with the Lord of your heart. It's a beautiful, beautiful saying right there. Always check your inner state with the Lord of your heart. And then comes a reference to alchemy. Alchemy being the transmutation of base metal into gold. Copper doesn't know it's copper until it's turned to gold. Your loving doesn't know its majesty until it knows its helplessness. Well, I looked at that. I thought, oh my heaven, this is unbelievable. That wasn't what I expected the last line was going to be. Your loving doesn't know its majesty until it knows its helplessness. Well, I understood it because not only was my husband, Hob, dealing with increasing helplessness, but so was I. It was like we were in a free fall of helplessness in the face of this inexorable illness. And yet what was Rumi saying Rumi, the 15th century mystic, totally enlightened being, is saying that's when you discover the real depth of your love. And I'm getting all this energy at the top of my head while I share this with you because this is the truth. And it was such a gift to me. It was such a gift that I titled, the first edition of the book was titled, The Majesty of Your Loving. People didn't really get that either, and I understand why. The your was everybody. It wasn't just him. The majesty of our loving, it might say. We don't know how much will come to us when we're in a place of helplessness. And I think this is really important for those of us who are older and dealing more with death and dying and seeing helplessness in those we love. And yet what the teaching, I suppose the deepest thing that came through this experience to Hob and me was it was a deepening of love. And that was the copper being turned to gold. That was all the hard times becoming tender moments or loving moments or a moment of touch or just a tiny moment of connection between two human beings. This is what compassion is about. So the third step is finding right relationship to suffering. Now this is an interesting one because as the heart trembles in response to suffering, or as we listen to the cries of the world, compassion can also have the quality of equanimity. And we know this by watching somebody like the Dalai Lama or Thich Nhat Hanh or Nelson Mandela or Martin Luther King, these great ones who have seen so much suffering, and yet in the presence of that suffering, they have a very deep equanimity. Now, why is this? It's because compassion is a force. It's a power. It's a power of the heart. And the more we practice, the stronger that becomes. And furthermore, the more we practice, the more it opens us out to the world beyond our own story. I'll come back to that in a moment. So you could ask, but how is it possible in the face of suffering? We don't become indifferent. We don't disconnect. We stay intensely present and we stay open to the moment, whatever the moment is presenting to us. So ultimately, we have come to a place where we don't see things in polarities so much anymore as this is wrong. I don't like this. This is dark. This is, you know, we stop thinking so much in polarities and we simply accept the basic Buddhist teaching. In fact, it was the heart of the Buddhist teaching because he said, I teach one thing, suffering, the existence of suffering, and the end of suffering. So when you are established in that compassion with equanimity, that's really where you are. You're with that truth, that knowledge, that you do everything that you can, but you can't always change the circumstances. You just do the best you can. So I've already referred to the practice of handling the daily news. I hear sort of a murmur of chuckles going through this, through all of us, because it's a great place to practice. Sometimes I simply can't watch the news. I just can't. I have a friend right now who's taking a news fast because of the physical symptoms that she's been having. And she said, I'm feeling better. And this is to say, we don't know always the subtle ways in which the power of these images are lodging in our psyches, in our bodies, and are affecting us. So I just put out there that we need to find a right relationship to suffering. How much can we hold? And sometimes we need to pull back. Sometimes, for instance, with a really difficult family situation or a dysfunctional relationship or something that we're finding really difficult, we may need to pull back. We may need to not go home. We may need to give space to whatever the challenge is. So finding our right relationship is really important. Now, there are many practices that help us to find this right relationship to suffering. So I want to start with some of the obvious ones, like we learn compassion for the body through our meditation practice. If you think about it, body scans, breath practices, working with the pain that comes up in meditation, this is all dealing with what comes to us at the physical level, and it's a really powerful place to work. Do you ever have sore knees or a sore back? I mean, those are sort of the first places that get hit when we start meditation, and so we start learning to work with our pain that way. And we begin to understand that this body is simply a microcosm of all bodies. We're joined through our understanding of sharing the physical suffering that comes with being in a body. That's an insight. That's really important right there. So that's the practices that help in working with the body. So compassion for the mind. The Buddha said that meditation is not about taming the mind, much as we'd like to. It's about training the mind. And I heard, maybe you'll relate to this, I heard something that just from a friend today that maybe you've had this feeling that you have the most difficult mind, that no one has a mind that's as difficult as yours, that is as tumultuous as yours, that blows you around as much as yours. Do you ever have that feeling that nobody could possibly, I have the most challenging mind of anybody in this room. Has anybody felt that? Yeah, once in a while. So this friend of mine was telling me, she's writing a book, and it's about a piece of this book, where she was in her early 20s in a really difficult time in her life. And she felt driven crazy by her mind, literally. I mean, you know, just what am I going to, I can't sleep. I'm just possessed by the situation I'm in. And in her naivete, she thought, well, I'll just get a lobotomy. She told me the story in all seriousness. She said, I dressed up, I went to a psychiatrist, and I sat opposite him, and I said to him, I can't stand this mind of mine anymore. I want a lobotomy. And the psychiatrist looked a little surprised and said, well, let's see if there aren't a few other options. So she was serious. She really was. She thought maybe you could just cut out that part that was causing all the trouble. And, you know, I'm sure we've had those moments when we've thought, this mind of mine, what am I doing? How do I handle this? And, of course, it's absolutely what our practice is about. So we learn to bring loving attention to our confusion and to our chaos. I love that term, loving attention. Just that is a major, major step. So the Buddha once said, you could search the whole world over and not find anyone more deserving of compassion than yourself. Maybe you've heard that one before. You could search the whole world over and not find anyone more deserving of compassion than yourself. Because the sort of principle here is that you can't have compassion for another person unless you have compassion for yourself. So I want to draw on another powerful experience that I had, again, dealing with a very difficult situation, which was watching my husband's mind go. And I was in a really, really hard place one afternoon, and I remember exactly where I was. I was in the garden, and I was just feeling so alone and so desolate, and I was on the edge of tears, and something made me put my hand on my heart, and I just heard those words, compassion for myself. So I'd like to invite you to do just a short meditation. We'll do this together. If you would just take a comfortable position, and if you wish, put your hand over your heart center. And take a few long, deep breaths, feeling as though you're breathing into your heart center. And then see what it's like to repeat to yourself silently, "May I have compassion for myself?" May I have compassion for myself? May I have ease of heart? And see if you feel any sensations of warmth or of opening. May I have compassion for myself? And if you're dealing with some kind of a challenge in your life right now, and it comes to mind, just renew this affirmation. May I have compassion for myself? And then, as is the way with all loving kindness or metta practices, we start to extend that. May I have compassion for those in my life? May I have compassion for those people in my life? Maybe somebody comes to mind who is particularly suffering at this point, in which case you can send compassion to them. May they have ease of heart. May they feel compassion for themselves. And then we extend it even further. May we have compassion for all beings. May we have compassion for all beings. And just notice if there's been any change in your heart center as we've done this short meditation together, whether you notice any warmth or spaciousness or expansion. This is the heart of compassion that is opening. And so as you bring your attention back, in those moments, I'm reminded of a story. I wasn't there, but it made a really powerful impression on me. I've been fortunate enough to be with His Holiness the Dalai Lama for teachings, actually twice at Radio City Music Hall in New York. Unlikely place, but amazing to be with him and to see how they turn the stage where the Rockettes do their thing into a sacred space by hanging a beautiful gold silk hanging to the back of the stage, and then they have a dais where His Holiness sits, and then there were, I've seen this, so this is how I can describe this part, maybe 60 nuns and monks on both sides of him. So you felt as though you were walking into a temple. And although I wasn't present for these particular teachings, this is what happened. The Dalai Lama was giving very high teachings about Manjushri, the archetype of wisdom in the Tibetan tradition. And he was talking about how we are all interconnected and how compassion prevails everywhere. And these, like we just did, this meditation is an aspiration for compassion. It's setting a very high ideal, if you will. And so he was talking about these high teachings, but he suddenly stopped in the middle of it. He broke right into the middle of his own talking. And he almost cried out, but that's not the way it is. That's not the way it is. That's not the way the world is. And he put his head down and he wept openly. You can imagine what a moment that was and what a powerful teaching that was too, because what it was telling us, I wasn't there, but I've got the teaching, which is that there are times when we're overwhelmed by some situation. It's more than we can hold. That moment came to him, but not, he didn't fight it. He didn't avoid it. He let those feelings pour through him to the point of breaking down into tears and crying in front of 4,000 people. And then in a very short time, because he let the feelings move right through him, he sat up and he blew his nose and he went right on. Now, I know, it's kind of amazing, isn't it? To me, it's a very heartwarming story, both that he was touched, because you know, maybe you've seen these pictures of him receiving the refugees coming out of Tibet. And he hears stories of murder and torture and rape. He hears about families that have been destroyed. He hears about terrible, terrible suffering. And so he has to hold that too. So that story to me is it's a very powerful teaching. That's what came to me out of that meditation with you. So here's the fourth step. And this is, in a way, by far the most challenging one. But I'm going to go for it anyway. So it's the relationship between compassion and shunyata, or emptiness, which is one of the most tricky concepts in the Buddha's teachings. Let me come at it this way. Throughout his life, the Buddha encouraged his students to contemplate these words. This is not me. This does not belong to me. This is not who I am. I'll say it again. This is not me. This does not belong to me. This is not who I am. What he is saying is that we have a body, but we are not the body. We have a mind, but we are not the mind. Some people have a bit of trouble with that one. But you know that thoughts stream through our mind. There's a mind consciousness. It's constantly changing. And at no point can you point at it and say, that's me. We have a mind. Same way with feelings, constantly coming and going. So we have feelings, but we're not our feelings. So what are we? This is a pretty big one. He's trying to help us to disidentify, if you will, from the ways in which we create a solid identity. This is who I am. This is my story. This is the I story. This is my narrative. And you know, I say this with a lot of warm feeling because I'm in the game just as much as everybody in this room, but we spent a lot of time fortifying that story, fortifying this sense of me. In fact, sometimes we feel as though it's a matter of life and death. That's a little strong, but it's true, you know. It's like, whoa. So the Buddha's trying to point to something very, very subtle. At the heart of things, we are simply pure awareness. We're that knowing. We're something very subtle, pure, spacious awareness. So meditation practice begins to reveal to us those moments between thoughts, where there's a flash of spaciousness, where there's a flash of freedom, where there isn't that I story going on, where there's, I think another word for emptiness is openness, okay? Shunyata, openness. They say, many of the teachers who write about this, that shunyata is very hard to translate, that emptiness is not a good translation of it. So what we're pointing here to is the experience that we have when we become more deeply absorbed, when the mind quiets down, when feelings are quieted, when the body is still, and there's a sense of space opening up. So how does that relate to compassion? Well, it's because when we're in that spacious place, we feel our connection to all that's around us, to other beings. And to me, one of the mysteries of having done a lot of retreats is that I feel even more connected to people when I'm on retreat than I do when I'm in my everyday life. And I think it's because we open our field to include something way beyond our ordinary I story, the story of me. So it's the cessation of our misunderstandings, of our confusion. And what the Buddha said was, emptiness is the wisdom born of uprooting illusion. It's uprooting the attachment to I and me and mine. It's the uprooting of our attachment to our sense of being a separate self. It's feeling our connection to all beings. It's such an extraordinary potential that we have to realize that. So it's a receptive, non-judging, boundless way of being open. And it opens the heart, and it leads to our longing to relieve the suffering of others. That's what happens. That's what comes with it. It opens our heart. So that's the connection. I've made an effort here. The connection between compassion and shunyata. It's a big one, but maybe we've touched it. So I want to end with one of the most inspiring stories that I've heard about compassion. I've heard it told actually now 3 or 4 times. The first time was when I was at the Mind-Body Clinic, and one of the Dalai Lama's physicians came to talk to us. His name was Chodrak, and he'd been in the Chinese prisons for many, many years, and his face was partially paralyzed from having been beaten. And yet, what he told us was, we dared not lose compassion for our jailers. And so I want to tell you about another specific story, because I have this image so strongly in my mind. This is about the Venerable Ani Pachen. And she became a leader in the resistance to the Chinese because from the part of Tibet where she lived, her father had been the tribal chief or whatever of that area. And when he died, she succeeded him. And she had to become the tribal chief, what is it? What's the word for a woman? Chieftain? Anyway, priestess, whatever. She stood in that role. And so, of course, she became a target for the Chinese, who captured her, threw her into jail. She was in prison for 20 years. 20 years. Just try to think about what that might be like. They brainwashed her. They tortured her. They put her into, they took her clothes away and put her into an ice-filled room. This is unbelievable. Of course, they dealt with starvation, just terrible conditions. They tried to break her faith, but she would not renounce it. They tried to have her renounce the Dalai Lama, who was her teacher, but she would not do that. And in fact, it was in prison that she was ordained as a nun. I love this. The Tibetans were holding a whole sort of clandestine, I don't know how they did it, but they did. They managed to ordain each other when they could, and they did everything they could to continue with their practices. So the photograph that I saw of her was after she came out, and you see this woman in probably her 50s, late 50s, I don't know, and she's looking right at the camera with this radiant face. There's not a trace of hostility in it. And what you see is inner resilience, you see endurance, you see courage, you see compassion. And what she said was the same thing that Chodrak had said. What we were most afraid of was not the hunger, was not the cold, was not the torture, but that we would lose compassion for our jailers. And you know, if you think about that, I don't know what it does for you, but it pretty well blows me away. That degree of compassion, that degree of survival, to me is really, really inspiring. But I want to come back. That's kind of beyond our realm to take in almost, and say that compassion and action in our lives can take very small forms, and they are just as important, that everything we do matters, that the smile you give the person passing in the street, or that, as I said earlier, that the touch or the deep listening or just the way you receive another person, these are our gifts of compassion to those in our lives. And so we may not be the heroes and heroines of these people who've been in Chinese prisons, but I think that we should have compassion for ourselves, that we are doing all we can in our lives to bring more compassion into the world. So I'd like to stop there. And, you know, it's like, may we cultivate compassion for ourselves and for those in our lives and for everyone in this world to the extent that we can. So with that, thank you very much for your listening.